Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. Justices on the state Supreme Court debate Governor Tony Evers' sweeping veto powers after he locked in school funding increases for the next four centuries. Plus, President Joe Biden visits the Badger State to announce an aggressive approach aimed at clean drinking water. And what new K-12 test scores tell us about the state of education. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for October 11th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This week, we're going to begin with the state Supreme Court hearing oral arguments. If you may remember, it was last year when Governor Tony Evers got very creative with his partial veto pen to increase school funding for the next 400-plus years. Of course, that caused a big uproar, and now the argument was before justices this week. What they called it and described Governor Evers' partial veto powers that locked in school funding increases were some of the terms like crazy and absurd, even though we've known for a very long time the governor has had these expansive powers to alter state budgets, etc., with his veto pen. Now, despite their odd ideological differences on the bench, justices all seem to agree that the broad veto powers that governors have had need some limitations, but they did struggle to define what that would be. Let's first just hear some of the candid responses from justices on the bench earlier this week about this case.
I think that there is concern that now we've got this 402-year veto. It does feel like the sky is the limit, the stratosphere is the limit, right? And perhaps today we are at that fork in the road. I think we're trying to think, like, should we today, in 2024, start to look at this differently?
We have a kind of a mess. I mean, I think if you took any person who was around when this amendment was adopted, they would be shocked. Which is why when legal scholars and others who look at what we do in our body of case law, and they think it's crazy, because it is crazy. We allow governors to unilaterally create law that has not been proposed to them at all. It is a mess of this court's making.
Justices are likely to make a decision in the coming months, but this once again just puts the forefront of the governor's veto powers really at an arguable debate, because this has been something that has been brought up for many, many years. Of course, the governor's veto powers have been chipped at away since the 1930s, but where this may go might have to be through legislation or a constitutional amendment, depending on the outcome.
Well, that was interesting about the debate with the court. A lot of the justices spoke had a concern about, well, this may go too far. The trouble is, Ann Walsh Bradley, a liberal, said, okay, lawmakers had a chance to rein in numbers and didn't. What I mean is, back in 1990, as we call it, the Vanna White veto, governors could strike out injured letters and create new words. There's an amendment approved by voters to end that practice. Walsh said they didn't talk about numbers, and talked to the attorney who's trying to challenge us, saying, you're telling me that letters are numbers. 4-year-olds know that's not the same thing. So what do we do here? One of the attorneys for the Department of Justice, Colin Roth, defending the veto, said, look, there are several options here. One, lawmakers can override the veto. Two, go to amendment and actually change it to prohibit this. Or three, write better bills. Basically, you know, and this is a process that goes through, and remember, this is only for appropriation bills. But lawmakers for decades have gone through the language of every appropriation bill and said, okay, where can the governor do things? It's why, after Joint Finance finishes his budget and lawmakers get it, they have experts who go over the document and pour for every single word, every hyphen. Where could they mess with us if they get the opportunity? Governor Evers basically outfoxed lawmakers with his veto. I know people are unhappy about it. They think it's 400 years. This is crazy. But he used the tools available to him at the time. My question is, even with Justice Carofsky saying, this is a fork in the road, this may be too much, where will they come down about what the limit is? What if he'd only done 10 years?
Right.
What if it was 12?
I think it would have been a different discussion. Yeah.
So is it because it's the length of time? Well, then what's your standard going to be? Like, that's the challenge here. Now, what's interesting is, will this decision come down before the next budget is drafted and sent back to the governor, and sometime hopefully in June of 2025, to know if his power will be reined in again. But I've watched this for years. Governor's aides are often quite proud of themselves. They'll tell you about, we found we could do this if we wanted to. I remember one former aide to Tommy Thompson told me they had figured out a way to veto the language out to take all the furniture out of Jim Doyle's office. He was the attorney general at the time. So they didn't do it, but they're like, that's how creative they are.
Right.
This power is expansive. And one of the things to remember is, created in 1930, there's a 1940 Supreme Court ruling that basically said, what you have to have left is a workable law. And DOJ this week said, look, there's a workable law left. That's your standard. Rebecca Bradley, a conservative, said, but that's not in the Constitution, right? And she was making the argument that this court, and the court acknowledged, the justices of the Supreme Court, going back decades, have basically come down the side of the governor time and time again, expansive power. Have we gone too far, they kept asking. That's the question. Like, where is the line they're going to draw, if they draw one, in this decision?
Right, and I think my next question is, what do we see regardless of this outcome? Because we've already seen lawmakers try to propose changes to the veto powers. It didn't really go anywhere. We saw an override by the state Senate, but it was never taken up in the state assembly. You know, do we see a constitutional amendment proposed next year? Because, of course, Governor Evers, if he gets a bill on his desk that's going to restrict his powers, I bet you 100% he's not going to sign it. So we can maybe see another avenue with constitutional amendments, which we've seen, of course, a lot this year. It's not going to be on people's ballots this year. Related to non-citizens voting. So that could be the avenue down the road, but kind of where the debate goes
one
is...
thing, 400 years sounds really dramatic. Remember, this is the cap on spending between what districts get from the state and property taxes. And so it's an increase each year going forward. Yes, he changed it so there'd be an annual increase for 400 years. Lawmakers get a shot every 2 years to change that. If they could strike a deal with Governor Evers next spring, they could change that law. So it's not like it's a forever thing, but in theory, it is locked in for 400 years. But my bet is it'll be an effort to try and change that in the next budget.
Right. All right. Let's move on to the next topic this week. We're going to shift to the U.S. Senate race because GOP candidate Eric Hovde was at an event with the Rotary Club and co-hosted by the Milwaukee Press Club. I was on the panel. He answered a wide variety of issues, and we're just going to highlight some of the newsier ones. So on Tuesday, he called for sweeping cuts to the federal budget and suggested raising the eligibility age for Social Security for people under the age of 40 years old. At the luncheon, he also said that he would vote to certify the results of the 2024 election and made calls to restore confidence in our elections. Now, during Hovde's opening remarks, he also criticized both administrations, the former president and the current administration, for the federal debt. Let's just hear him kind of on his overall pitch to voters before we dive into the details.
I am very concerned the direction that our country has headed. And it's been going on for a long time, but particularly the last 4 years. We are bankrupting ourselves. We have racked up more debt in the last 3.5 years than our country's first 230-year history. We have $35 trillion in debt. The interest cost on that debt is $1 trillion a year. That means the cost of carrying that debt is bigger than our Defense Department budget. Within a year and a half, it'll be bigger than our largest cost, which is Social Security, which, by the way, CBO just put out a report, it will start going cash flow negative in 8.5 years. To me, that is immoral, because we are bankrupting not only our future, but we're robbing from my children, our children's, and grandchildren's future. Because when you deficit spend, all you do is you pull growth from the future into today. That needs to be fixed.
So he also kind of went after some of the campaign ads that are on the air right now that he says are false and misleading, which we know, you know, regardless of what is said in the ad, TV stations have to air them, and they're getting a little bit more polarizing over the years. But that's why some of these issues were brought up specifically too, like Social Security.
Well, what's interesting is how you're saying this is a lie, but he did say he wants to raise retirement age. He did say he wants to cut benefits. Now, he said that back in 2012, that campaign, but he has advocated for that before. He's adding nuance here that, well, I'm not talking about people who are getting the program or close to it. I'm talking about those 40 younger. And if we had an honest discussion about Social Security, it is not on a path of solvency right now. There is going to be a problem. So what do you do? Both parties have a problem proposing solutions to that. They keep on add more and promising, I'm not going to touch anything. Well, how do you fix it? So that aside, Hovde is taking issue with that stuff. you know, he's trying to push back on this constant attack from Baldwin about him being quote-unquote a jerk. What's wrong with this guy? I'm a California banker. What's interesting is he brings up the attack to defend himself sometimes. Mm-hmm. And in politics, if you're doing that, you're reinforcing the attack somewhat. I know he's offending himself, but it's not really how a lot of politicians do this. Example of how Heavily's not a traditional politician, quote-unquote, and maybe is starting to feel like a little personal affront with the attacks he's getting hit with by Baldwin and
right.
their allies.
And speaking on the abortion issue, too, there's that ad saying that I fully support a federal abortion ban, but he, like many Republicans, of course, in a pivotal election year, have shifted their position on that issue. He's kind of in the U.S. Senator Ron Johnson lane, where let's put a referendum before voters on when that should be discussed, on when abortion laws should be, you know, depending on the weeks, when that should be ordered here in the state. Speaking of IVF, too, he said he fully supports that treatment. He even said, quote, that me and my wife tried it. He didn't elaborate on that, but tried to get a little bit personal with audience members. Also asked him about climate change, giving, you know, the horrible tropical storms that have hit in just the past week or two, Helene and Milton. He believes, quote, man is influencing climate change. It's been, you know, an interesting topic that some Republicans have danced. Of course, we know the former president is very critical of the issue. So it seemed to me overall, asking Hovde on this panel some questions, he took a step back from former President Donald Trump, even to saying, hey, guys, let's stop talking about these election conspiracies. Let's stop saying the election was stolen. Let's move on. However, he did say right after that, well, if there is mass fraud, we might need to reevaluate things. So it's once again Republicans like Hovde walking a very fine line, trying to still not go too far, but staying in the lane to not upset former President Donald Trump, because we've seen before, if you cross him, it can hurt you. Absentee ballot drop boxes. He has absentee voted a handful of times. So I asked him about that as well. Do you support absentee voting? Because we know the RNC platform and former President Donald Trump prefer one-day voting on the same day by paper ballot. Hovde pushed back against that. He likes absentee voting, but he hates, to put it bluntly, absentee ballot drop boxes, which we've known that he has criticized in the past before.
Yeah, and the polls we're seeing now show why he's not going to ever abandon Trump, because he needs Trump mm-hmm. to pull him across the finish line. From what we're seeing in these polls.
All right. And looking at polls, we have a new one this week out of Quinnipiac University. And, of course, the race is tight. But this comes after we saw a 7-point advantage by Senator Tammy Baldwin just a few days ago in the Marquette poll, which raised a lot of eyebrows. Then we saw Axios' story saying the race is much closer. An internal poll by Baldwin is only a 2-point margin. Now we're looking at this one right here is 46 Hovde, 50% Baldwin. Still very close.
So the Cook Political Report moved this race to a toss-up. And the question I've been getting from people is, well, is that because there's momentum that Hovde's creating, or is it because it's Wisconsin, it's October, right? We are a 50-50 state. So there might be a little bit of both. On the Wisconsin front, look, we're a pretty even state. If you look at the kind of dig down these polls a little bit, yes, it's 50-46, and one almost the same another poll I saw this week. But Hovde is at like 91% with Republicans, where Trump's at 95. It shows he has room to grow. Also, Baldwin's leaked her internals to some media outlets this week, saying that has her up 2, but Harris down 3. That stuff, alarm bells. What's going on? You know, is there something happening here? Well, it feels like there is some kind of momentum for Trump, that Harris has been on this kind of high from post-convention, getting in the race. It's now kind of like come back to earth a little bit, and there's some things to worry about. If that trajectory continues, there's an avenue for Hovde to win. If Trump wins Wisconsin by a point or two, that's his ticket to beating Baldwin. The other thing now about creating his own momentum, in talking to people the last few weeks about Hovde's ads, like we mentioned with Hovde and the attacks from Baldwin, it's he's a jerk. What's wrong with this guy? The things are pounded in time and time again. Hovde has been more kind of, I don't say all over the map, but he's been hitting on immigration and fentanyl, other issues, but there hasn't been a consistent like two-faced Tammy or, you know, whatever. Couple things are happening now. One, there's the attack that she's been washing for 25 years and she's changed. That's an effective line no matter what party you're in. If you've gone D.C.,
career politician,
that mm-hmm. can hurt. We're seeing now, though, the rise of trans ads, transgender issues. Hovde and two groups back, you've been running ads the last couple weeks that talk about Baldwin-supported surgery for minors, this money for a Madison not nonprofit helping transgender kids, women and girls playing boy sports, et cetera. Talking to Democrats, they are seeing some subtle movements in their polling. they're worried that that is starting to move people because they don't have a great pivot on that. Look at immigration with Kamala Harris. Immigration was like the driving thing against her. She's now said, I support that bipartisan border bill. I would do X, Y, and Z. They've got an answer for that. On crime, I'm a prosecutor. They have an answer on that. There is no Democratic response to the transgender issue attack because they're not going to abandon their part of their base, which is, you know, includes people who are transgender. They're not going to do that. So what do you do? There isn't a way to pivot or to respond. You have to pivot off of that to something else. And they're worried this attack continue. And it's not just in Wisconsin. New York Times has a story this week that Republicans spent $65 million on ads in the last, I think, month on trans issues. Republicans hope this will neutralize the abortion issue, that they can somehow, with especially female voters, this is going to at least hold court with some of them, maybe bring them back in the fold. We shall see. Mm-hmm. The gender gap is growing in the polls that we're seeing, but this is something to watch. Does this new tact on these issues start to cause problems for Baldwin?
I will say that message of transgender issues and the Harris ad attacking her for using taxpayer funds to pay for a prisoner sex change. I was in Sauk and Columbia County this week talking to voters. Of course, both areas are very swing counties in the swing state because they've gone back and forth, blue, red, over the years. And that was something that almost every Republican voter that I talked to talked about and they were concerned about, which beforehand, it was weeks ago, going out in the field talking to voters at events and stuff, it was immigration economy. So to me, that messaging is working with some people. So it's fascinating to see because I don't think anyone, you know, goes to the polls for one single issue. I mean, of course, a lot of people, I think, is the economy. But that could be something that is resonating because usually if you watch an ad, sometimes you forget about it and you go out through your day, busy lives. But that one is sticking with some voters. So that would be interesting to see how motivating that will be, especially for those undecided or, you know, moderate Republicans who are not sold on Trump yet. All right, let's move on to President Joe Biden visiting Wisconsin this week to tout lead pipe removal. He made the announcement in Milwaukee. About $2.6 billion will be in funding to replace all lead pipes across the United States. Now, the move will require all lead pipes to be replaced within 10 years, and that funding will come from the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act. Let's just hear a little bit from the president in Milwaukee earlier this week.
We know safe, clean drinking water is fundamental to the health of our communities, to enhance our economic growth, to basic human dignity. That's why we've already replaced 367,000 lead pipe services all across America. For too long, local communities have known how important it was to deal with this problem. It hadn't been given the national priority it demanded, though. I'm here today to tell you that I'm finally insisting that it gets prioritized, and I'm insisting to get done. Not only are we setting a priority, we're showing up as a partner to get it done. Over the past couple years, we provided billions of dollars to states and communities to address this problem. And today, I'm announcing an additional $2 billion.
So this is, of course, not as many times that Biden comes back, but he's still trying to come here, tout things about the administration to try and help Vice President Kamala Harris. And this is an issue that is very important, of course, to Milwaukee residents. And as you know, clean drinking water, I think everyone agrees, is a bipartisan issue. We even heard Hovde earlier in the week saying, yeah, I support using federal funds for that. You know, clean drinking water is important. How much it really sways voters, you know, depends, but it is a big announcement by the administration.
Second piece of that is addressing lead paint, which is still an issue in Milwaukee, and then also is a problem for kids.
Right. All right. Now let's get to DPI test scores that were released this week. And kind of the big headline out of this, which is no surprise because it's been ongoing for a very long time, is there are still major racial disparities that persist between students of color and white students in English language arts. And that's, of course, according to the new statewide test results that came out this week. Now, the results for the 2023-2024 school year were released after DPI came under fire this year for implementing new categories for students when it comes to categorizing their achievement. And critics argue that it masks poor performance because they used to have terms like below basic, basic, proficient, advanced to describe student performance. Those terms were changed to developing, approaching, meeting, and advanced. Now, it's important to note, too, due to these changes, you can't really compare to years past because of the verb changes. So that's kind of the hidden message in these test results.
Yeah, but the one thing that comes through is even if you can't compare to past, you still see the racial gap that is there. It is consistent. Now, DPI does not call it an achievement gap. They call it an opportunity gap. They are advocating for more investments in public education because of this. Others will tell you, look, we've been increasing education funding for years. Nothing has changed. We need a different trajectory. It goes also the argument you're going to hear from Republicans about school choice and vouchers that, look, there's an issue for kids. The way to address it is not to keep putting money in Milwaukee public schools. It's to give people opportunity to get out of Milwaukee public schools. Not to pick on MPS, but that's something you're going to hear this next budget debate if this becomes an issue.
All right, and staying on the topic of DPI, we have a new candidate who announced would like to go up against the current state superintendent, which is Jill Underle. That is Jeff Wright. He is the superintendent of Sauk Prairie Schools right now, who announced his bid actually last Friday after we taped the show. In a statement, he said he looks forward to working with Wisconsinites from across the state to ensure a strong future for our schools. Now, this comes as Wright has claimed that he has the backing of WEAC, which is the Wisconsin Education Association Council, which is the Wisconsin's largest teacher union. And this comes as Republican lawmakers have really criticized Underle over the years for things like she's focusing too much on LGBTQ issues, not enough on reading and math. So it would be kind of a fascinating race to look at next year before we get over this one.
So like, when Underle announced she's going to run again a month or two ago,
yeah.
We had been hearing rumblings that WEAC and her were not on the same page. They're looking for somebody else. So now the PAC has recommended Jeff. They have not fully endorsed him. So the next is the union to actually vote on the endorsement. But it is clear WEAC wants somebody different. The challenges for Wright are several. One, Underle's an incumbent. She also got like $960,000 from the State Democratic Party in 2021 for her race. If she's viewed as an incumbent Democrat endorsed by the party, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
That's hard to overcome. Number two, will the choice/conservative/Republican movement field a candidate? They are not fans of Underle's, but Republicans will tell you they've made this half-hearted attempt over the years to try and win the DPI race, and they just haven't done it. They've talked about running somebody really conservative, like a Don Pridemore, former Republican lawmaker, ran, did not do very well against Tony Evers. They've talked about a Moms for Liberty candidate. That's not what the public has been looking for. Now, things can always change, but if passes prologue, that's how they've been looking for. If you are basically a teacher education person with the backing of WEAC and the establishment, you tend to win these races.
Mm-hmm.
So will those folks on the right, will they say, you know what, we're going to hold back, hope that Wright is at least agnostic about choice because Underle, they view her as hostile toward it, and maybe he'll be better for us. Now, at the same time, if you're backed by WEAC, are you going to be really agnostic about choice? Like,
right.
They're not big fans. So
yeah.
There's that. And then third, there's a Supreme Court race in the ballot next spring. The last one was $56 million plus in spending. This one will be, again, about control of the court. How do you get a message out with that kind of spending going on, we expect, in a Supreme Court race, right? So it might be better for Wright if there is a primary in February, because right now the Supreme Court race is just two people, Susan Crawford, Dane County Judge, on the left, Brad Schimmel, former Republican Attorney General, on the right, now Waukesha County Judge. If there's nobody else in that race, it's just them on the ballot in April. You get a primary in February, maybe a chance to leave an imprint on voters then. But think about that spending.
It's going to be noisy.
Yes.
Very noisy.
So those are challenges for Jeff Wright. And, you know, Underle's got her challenges as well. Remember, she's criticized Milwaukee because they didn't bring to light the problems with MPS and its filings of documents ahead of a $252 million referendum. There are vulnerabilities there, but there's some dynamics to watch with that race as it develops after November.
I know. I was like, let's take a pause. But we got to let people know what's going on next year. All right. Let's get to stock picks this week, and we're looking at Rebecca Cook.
So, fundraising reports aren't due until October 15th, but Cook put out her number of 2.75 million raised in this recent quarter. That's a good number. I don't care if you're a challenger or an incumbent. Pretty eye-popping. Now, this is a district that has kind of gotten more Trumpy over the years. So having money is great, but how do you overcome that nature of that district? And a week ago, at the Congressional Leadership Fund, a Republican group that helps House candidates, put out polling saying Derek Van Orden's in good shape. Strong position, 49-44 for Van Orden. Well, if they weren't worried, they wouldn't be doing $1.5 million in ads, which they announced this week in the third. So my question is, what's going on here? Because some things don't quite make sense. On the one hand, Cook's raising good money. She has a spending advantage on TV the last 4 weeks of the race. So House Majority PAC has got like $4 million reserved. Vote Vets is like 1.7. Like, she's got a decent advantage on the air last 4 weeks. Good for her. But it's not a 50-50 district. It is a Republican-leaning one. So if we got a 50-50 ball game in the presidential race, How do you make that race competitive? Mm-hmm. That's what I can't figure out. But then there's this other alternative view of, it's not just about her winning, it's about helping the top of the ticket. So bear with me here. Usually races are driven top down. Like that's what we see, like President Harris drives everything. Mm-hmm. Democrats have a theory this year that the more people you have out in the field talking about issues that are good for them, the better it is. If Cook has this money and she's on the campaign trail and she's touting all these things, that could be a boost for Kamala Harris and for Tammy Baldwin, which seems crazy. Why don't you spend that money in the presidential race or the Senate race? But I digress. Also, if there's a chance to win that seat, because the map is wide open right now, Republicans are holding on to a narrow majority, you don't want to miss a chance to win a seat, so maybe that's what's going on. And then finally, with these groups, donors sometimes go, I'm going to give you this much money to play in that race.
Yeah.
Like, I've got a personal beef with so-and-so, so there might be that going on. But either way, watch this district. I get the impression that she needs a good performance by Harris, top of the ticket, to win it. Tony Evers won the seat in 2022 over Tim Michaels, winning by statewide by 3.4 points. But Ron Johnson won it by 5.5 points when beating Mandela Barnes by a point. So it tells you that she needs a little bit of momentum in top to win. So keep an eye on it. It's just kind of interesting on spending going on there.
Right. That whole part of the state is going to be fascinating in the fall. All right. Let's get to Mix This Week and Tony Phillips.
A month ago, we talked about Senate Democrats pulled their ad buys in the 18th Senate District, which runs along Lake Winnebago, the western edge, and over in the 32nd in western Wisconsin with Brad Paff. And Dems were telling me these races are done. Like, there's the polling is pretty good. And a Republican operative is telling me they don't look very good for us. We're going to focus on these other races instead of this. Well, here comes Restoration PAC, which is Dick Uihlein's PAC, essentially. They filed notice to the state they're going to spend $630,000 in this race. Yeah, I know. Sorry. $630,000 in this race on TV going with Kristen Alfheim. It's like, whoa, where's that coming from? And in talking to people, my impression is there are a couple things going on here. One, Kristen Alfheim is a member of the Appleton City Council. She ran in 2022 for the old 19th Senate District, which was, you know, a slight Republican-leaning district, but Tony Evers won it in 2022. She lost to Rachel Carbajal-Guevara, did 5 points worse than Evers in that district. So this is a 54% Dem district, now the 18th. If she underperformed by that much this time, that might open the door to a win. The second thing, again, questionable spending practices, but there's a theory that if Republicans spend money here, it forces Democrats to respond, which prevents them from going to spend money in the 30th up in the Green Bay area, or in the 14th where Joan Baldwin, Republican State Senator, is trying to win a Democratic-leaning seat against Sarah Kayeski, or in the 8th where it's Jody Habersinick, a Democratic attorney, versus GOP State Senator Dubie Strobel. Again, you think, why don't you spend in those races, but maybe you're going, okay, Republicans run the doors hard, they say. This candidate has underperformed before, and they're not spending money there. Let's take a shot. Maybe it helps. So that might be what's going on, but Democrats will tell you that they are so confident that even on a bad night, they'll win this seat because it's so Democratic.
Right. All right. And let's get to Falling This Week, which is dam safety after a new Wisconsin policy reform report.
Yeah. So just real quick, we had the second most dam failures in the country between 2000 and 2023. The one I remember most vividly was in 2008 when a highway washed out the Dells and like took out this lake and five houses at the same time. The good news is we've got money every budget to help repair the dams. There's been no major loss of life in any of these things, but Evers keeps saying fix the damn roads. I mean, fix the damn dams at some point, too.
Way to end the show. Right. All right, that will do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We'll see you next time.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.